Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. I always find this little pause between doing the Namo Tassa and then starting the talk to be kind of a stressful situation. And that usually that bit of time, well, the meditation period before that, usually going through the head what I might be talking about. And usually there's two or three different scenarios that sort of come up. And what kind of is interesting for me is, like, you know, tonight is sort of like this sense of, you know, like how you begin the talk actually is important, in that it gives direction for the rest of the talk, gives you know, sort of guidance. If you started out on the right foot, you know, hopefully it will progress in a smooth way, in a way that's helpful. And that's kind of what I've been thinking about the last couple of weeks, is you know, that the retreat, you know, would be ending soon. And so I think, you know, tomorrow night will probably be the sort of formal ending of the winter retreat. And, you know, I was thinking the last couple of years, you know, even 2 years ago, starting as early as November, in some of the Dhamma talks, talking about setting the mind, you know, even in early November of preparing for the winter retreat, you know, thinking of not taking on as many sort of personal projects, duties, things like, or not duties, but, you know, personal projects in the month of December, setting things down, wrapping up the projects that we do have responsibilities for, and also turning the mind towards, like, what is it that you want to investigate during the 3 month retreat? What is it that you want to, what, you know, excites the mind, interests the mind? Where's the interest? And, you know, spend time doing some sutta readings, or, you know, gathering materials that you might be find useful during the winter retreat, so you don't have to engage with other people to find, you know, resources and information, even though everybody's, this winter retreat's been very helpful with supporting each other that way. It's always, to me, it's always been important to start the winter retreat with, you know, setting the ground, setting the intention, and then partly that just makes the transition into the retreat smoother. It's not like this sort of hitting a wall at the end of December, you're rushing to get things done, and then that rushed energy then, you know, hitting the wall of silence, or that wall of not doing anything. And so likewise, right now, we're kind of coming to the end of the retreat, but we're also entering a beginning of the non-retreat time. And of course, that means, you know, many different things. It means more guests coming, visitors, Dhamma teachers, other monastics. It means some monastics will be leaving, going on to different locations, and having Ajahn Karunadamo and Ajahn Yatiko returning, Ajahn Siddhanto and Ajahn Punadamo arriving soon. You know, guests arriving means a lot more traveling for the community, going off to various teaching engagements we'll have. Means a work scene. Most mornings we'll have, you know, working to do. People taking on more responsibilities, kitchen managing and guest monking and all sorts of things. And so, you kind of, this talk tonight hopefully is kind of, you know, about setting the intention, the mood for that. You know, it doesn't have to be a negative thing. Some people really enjoy not being on retreat. You know, it can be a time of creating a lot of wholesome karma. There's many aspects of Dharma that we can learn while we're not on retreat. You know, how we interact with each other, how we help each other. More opportunities to discuss Dhamma with individuals, to getting different perspectives from different people being here. One of the morning reflections last year was that Ajahn Sona was talking about, if you had a problem or an issue with somebody, to not to be approaching that sort of situation with rehearsing like what it is that you want to say, so you're getting all your facts and information all kind of lined up and on this date you said this, but what I was really struck by was, he said, rehearsing the mood. When you had to approach somebody, to talk to somebody, it was, what kind of, what's the goal in that interaction? What's the, what do I really, intend to say, from the heart? It's, I think everybody here, it's like if we have to interact with people, it's almost always with, goodwill, with good intentions to try to make things smooth or to help everybody. And so it's, practicing the mood. So I kind of see this, we're getting ready to enter into the more busy time of year. And so kind of practicing right now, next couple of days, probably three days anyway, before we really start getting into a lot more interactions. So it's, to start thinking about that. How can we be moving into that period of time, in a skillful way, and what kind of attitude do we want to take through the next 9 months before we get to go on winter retreat again, hopefully. And it's like, I think everybody would probably, not everybody, but most people would say we had just an incredible winter retreat. And and there's no reason why we can't have an incredible spring. There's no reason we can't have just an incredible Vasa, a really incredible fall. And so part of it is that just turning our minds to create. I mean, we'll be the ones that create that if that happens. Partly this reflection's come up, the evening readings that we've been doing the last couple of weeks, the last month, throughout the entire retreat, all the readings have, been the Thai forest masters, and it's been really refreshing. And Ajahn Amaro used to always talk about how the winter retreats were, for him, sort of an opportunity to kind of like recharge his batteries. And I think I always had a sense of what he meant by that, but it wasn't until this retreat that kind of, I really feel that way right now, sort of going into this next period of time, where I do feel much more refreshed and more just equanimous and looking forward to being in community. But listening to the talks, it's kind of dawned on me that, most of the talks have been, sort of very formal, our equivalent to Saturday night and the One Pra, those kinds of teachings. And of course, those teachings are set in a very, maybe very formal situation. And there is a kind of a way that you give those talks and subjects that you do talk about. But there's, so many different ways that being in community, that we learn, that we get instruction, that we, hear Dhamma. So much of the monastic practice is from the Vinaya, from the monastic rules, the etiquette, the way that each particular monastery sets up, the way we do things. And a lot of it is just, observing, watching, seeing good examples of community members, both lay people and monastics that have an impeccability to them, or just a willingness to try, even though they might they might fail and might suffer from it, but you can see the determination and just trying, and we can learn a lot from that. And we can see where we can learn from, you know, our own failing and, you know, seeing other people fail and how they react to that. So there's so many ways that we learn Dhamma that other than the way that the evening readings have been happening. And so, you know, just kind of remembering that, so that when we move into the, you know, this next period of time, just remember that there's so many other ways that we can learn Dhamma other than, you know, hearing the Dhamma talks or the meditation period. And so kind of opening the heart to that, that, you know, everything that we do is part of that learning process. Just a few days ago, there were a few themes that I was, you know, thinking about for tonight's talk as well, and picking up some suttas. And one of the monks had given me, I'd asked him if there was a phrase that I remembered that, having loving kindness, having thoughts of loving kindness, you know, doing bodily acts of loving kindness. Towards, you know, our friends, towards those companions in the holy life, you know, both in private and in public. And so I asked this monk, you know, if he remembered where that sutta was, and told me about it. And it's in the Majjhima Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya number 48, the Kosambian sutta. And it's interesting because it's the ending of it's slightly different, but in the Vinaya there's a kind of a famous story, you know, Vinaya Pitaka, where the monks of Kosambi are living together, and there's the Dhamma master and the Vinaya master there's an interaction where the Dhamma master is in the bathroom and leaves some water in a dipper, and after he leaves it there, and then the Vinaya master comes in and sees that, and then he just goes up and asks the Dhamma master if he had done that, and asked if he knew that was an offense, and he's like, oh no, I didn't know that, you know, thanks for pointing that out. And the Vinaya master's like, well, actually, if you didn't know it was an offense, then it's actually not an offense for you, because you didn't know it. And then they kind of part, and then the Vinaya master, though, goes back and sort of tells his students, you know, the Dhamma master doesn't even know the Vinaya. And, you know, he had an offense and didn't know it. And then so it sort of starts this kind of, the disciples of the Vinaya master, or the disciples of the Dhamma master, get kind of start spreading around, oh, the Vinaya master doesn't really know the rules, and something like this. And then so it just starts this quarrel, and they start quarreling with each other, and the Buddha actually is informed of this, and he comes and tries to quell the dispute, but they won't listen to him. And they actually sort of one of the monks actually tells him, you know, just let us settle this, you know, you can leave. And and so the Buddha actually leaves the area and goes off to be in seclusion. And then, you know, over time, the lay people of Kosambi get upset that these quarreling monks were the reason that the Buddha left. And so they end up actually stop feeding the monks. And then because of that, the monks actually go and find the Buddha. And the Dhamma master actually realized that, you know, so maybe he did have an offense, and then confesses it, and then everything's they do a ceremony, and they come back to harmony. So the Buddha, you know, to prevent the schism. And so that's the story that's in the Vinaya. And in the Majjhima Nikaya, the story goes that there is this quarreling going on, and the wording of it goes something like that one side is trying to say argue and trying to persuade one side, but they can't persuade the other ones, and then it goes back and forth, and neither one can persuade each other, and the phrase I like is that they're like stabbing each other with verbal daggers, and sort of they're brawling and disputing, and just creating situations that are obviously not conducive for meditation, for developing spiritual life. And so the Buddha calls them, and sort of, I always love this, and the Buddha sort of asks them, is it true that you are sort of brawling and creating disputes and stabbing each other with verbal daggers? And they, yes, we are. Foolish men, and then he sets out, he says that there are six conditions, or six, Bhikkhu Bodhi translated it two different ways. So there's six principles of cordiality is the way it was translated in the latest version of the Majjhima Nikaya. Another version had it as six memorable properties or traits that would lead to, I like this list, it says that would lead to love, would lead to respect, would conduce to helpfulness, would conduce to non-dispute, would lead to concord, and lead to unity. And the one phrase, say there's two different versions of the Majjhima Nikaya, and in the last version he had changed the helpfulness to cohesion, would lead to cohesion, which is an interesting image to me, in that when I first learned loving-kindness meditation, I was sitting in a retreat with Stephen Smith, and he mentioned that there's a phrase in Burmese about loving-kindness. I don't know if it's loving-kindness itself or just a way of talking about it, but it was called water drop connection, the kind of cohesion power of water. And you gave the example, like if you had two pieces of paper that are dry, that if you just had them sitting on a desk on top of each other, and just even the slightest breeze comes by, the papers will slide off. There's they have to have heavy weight on top of them to keep them from blowing around. But all you have to do, if you did just take just a single drop of water on, say, the bottom sheet, and then put the other sheet on top of it, the two sheets will stick together. So this that loving kindness is this sort of cohesive bringing together. And so I was always like that image, water drop connection, kind of loving kindness. So it was interesting that that's in there, the concord, unity, helpfulness, cohesion. So there's these six principles to develop, and then so these six principles are, I already mentioned the first one is maintaining bodily actions of loving kindness towards our friends, towards our community members, and again it's a lovely phrase too, both in public and in private, so it's doing things. Yeah. Actually, the real reason I thought about doing this is one of the monks' birthdays tomorrow, and I was going to pass down a present to him tonight, but I thought that's a little bit too extreme. And so I was doing a verbal or doing a physical act of appreciating somebody, showing somebody support and respect and love, but I'll do it verbally instead. So doing acts to help support each other and being kind. It's a very obvious ways of creating that cohesion in the community. And the other is verbal acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private. And then mental, doing loving kindness acts just mentally. So using meditation periods or just throughout the day, just creating that. I see it as creating that continuity. It's like there's so many more times that we're not around people, but just to keeping that intention in the mind, to creating that momentum in that direction of Every moment that there is a thought of loving kindness, there's not a thought of ill will. So it just, one way is just thinking of it as replacing. If we have a tendency to be negative or judgmental or critical, just replacing those thoughts with just the thought of, goodwill towards somebody, especially probably if it's, somebody that you are judgmental of, or if you have misperceptions of somebody, just bringing the thoughts of loving kindness just as a way of training the mind to think and be in a different way. So those are the three about, say, loving kindness. The fourth method, or fourth principle of cordiality is the, whenever we get any sort of physical gain, something that that we acquire in a dharmic way, in a right way, so something, not asking, getting something by, like, say, asking for it or hinting or something like that, but anything that comes to us that we acquire, to share that with other community members, just completely willingly. And to one of the monks here, is I think it's his mother, maybe it's his father as well, but whenever there's any sort of holiday where you could imagine sort of applying candy on children and things like that, she'll always send her son a big box of candy and stuff, and he always—I mean, he couldn't eat it all himself anyway if he tried. But he just a lot of joy in him, watching him share this this bounty of goodwill that he receives, this love. And so it always comes to my mind, whenever you get something to share it, and just to Sajjan Amaro again used to always say, it always tastes better when you share it. And so. That's the fourth way, and you can see too. It's like if you do that, and people know that you do that, that you're not hoarding things for yourself, and just trying to get things for yourself. That people have a lot more trust and confidence and appreciation for you, and so that's the fourth one. Fifth one is virtue. So it's. And again, this is interesting that it mentions again in public and in private. So, and it says having a virtue in common, like so that we have the same virtues in common, and we exhibit those and have those virtues. For one thing, is like we're all on the same page. So it's like all the monastics have. The same vinaya that we're training ourselves and we're thinking in very similar ways and acting in similar ways, dressing in similar ways, having attitudes and things that we hold dear to us in similar ways. And it's to do it in public, because that's where we're seen and where we. People know that we're acting that way and being that way, but also in private. So it's like there's certain etiquette rules that we have and things like that. And it's good to, I'm in private, so I don't need to do that. But it's to one of our etiquettes is that when we come into the shrine room that we bow to the Buddha image, and so we've brought that up several times during the winter retreat. Like we're in our cabins, to bow. It's like we could very easily, that's just a superstition, or I don't want to do that. But it is a virtue. It is a practice that is encouraged. And so it's like, so even at your cabin, to do these things that you would do them in the Dhamma hall, when everybody's here. So to train yourself to see a beauty in that, to see again, it's that continuity. It's like if it's something that you value doing in community life, then it should also be something you would value doing on your own, because you do it in community life because we choose to be here. And so it's we choose to be here because at some level, the practices are practices that we see value in and that we see them having benefits. So just the more we can continue to develop those practices. And then the sixth quality that to cordiality is again in public and in private is views, having, you know, kind of boils down to having right view, practicing seeing the value in the Four Noble Truths, and then of that the Eightfold Path, which Ajahn Nyaniko talked about the other day, and but you know, looking at right view, and bringing our views in line with that, and again, in the same way as with virtue, sort of just having that continuity of that both in public and in private. And then the Buddha, it's when he's talking to the Kosambian monks, he sort of says, of these six qualities, that having the same views, having the same sort of seeing, of course, in right view, it's there's a mundane right view and supramundane right view. So the mundane right view is basically seeing cause and effect and seeing karma, and then putting into practice the best we can the Four Noble Truths. And then the supramundane would be the having realizations, enlightenment experiences, understanding of the Four Noble Truths. A very basic explanation of that, but having our lives based on these right views. And so the Buddha said that of those six, that that would be the most profitable. Not that the other five aren't worth doing, or but that view is the most, the highest, the best way to be practicing. Now this is a really unusual talk for me because I'm getting into lots of lists, which is usually something that completely scares me. And Ajahn Hingsako, though brilliantly the other day, had his list written down on him. So I asked him if he would keep the list for me. So as I'm going through these next couple of lists, if I get stumped, he can cue me. So he's got his little mag flashlight ready to go. So the right views, the Buddha said that there were sort of seven ways of contemplating them, and I actually liked it. In the sutta, he actually says that. So it's like again, I think this list is important in terms of what we're doing. We're getting ready to leave the meditation retreat and going into this more busy time of year, and so we won't be able to possibly, the conditions that we had during the winter retreat for meditation were just superb this year. Just the quality of the retreat helpers, just the infectious generosity that all of you gave, just really supported the entire retreat and your dedication to practice. There was this real inspiration there for the rest of us, to see that. And then from all of us, there was, strong sense of this year of really being, quiet and not a whole lot of, discussions and people putting forth effort in the practice, sitting and walking and studying. And also too, like just the weather, January and February was, sunny and 75. Every day, so it was like getting outside practicing was just this really wonderful opportunity. And so now that we're going to be entering into a more busy time of year, it's really important to keep that in mind, that we may not be able to get as concentrated, the conditions won't be as conducive, but we still have that desire, we still have that want to spend time meditating, to spend time becoming, you know, more and more clear with our mind states and training ourselves in mindfulness and, you know, these states of loving kindness and supporting each other. So the sutta, when the Buddha starts talking about this right view, what it is to have this sort of investigation of right view, he starts off with just sort of says, you know, going out into the forest or going to the foot of a tree or going to an empty hut. Or if you're a layperson, you know, going back to your place where you have your shrine, where you meditate every day, or to the meditation group that you go to, wherever it is that you have formal meditation practice. He says, you know, so go to this place. You know, for us monks, it's to, you know, one of the benefits also of the retreat is like, you know, a lot of the habits that we get into during the 9 months of, you know, maybe being on the computer a lot or getting into conversations and things like that. You know, that 3 months we can kind of break that, and so the good habits that we've developed this last 3 months, you know, just to, instead of hanging out down here like we might do, just to go out into the forest, you know, go to the root of a tree, go to your empty cabin, make it not empty. And the Buddha says at those points, then the first thing to do is look at, is the mind obsessed? Is there any obsessions in the mind? And here's a list of eight. So the first five are the five hindrances. And, you know, looking at, is the mind, you know, occupied with any of these? In another sutta, in the Majjhima Nikaya, it's number 108, is a really lovely phrase, because he's talking about, you know, say with, you know, say a mind that's, it's, say, in being overrun by, say, sensual indulgence or ill will, you know, sloth and torpor, restlessness and doubt. So those are the five hindrances. If the mind is sort of involved in any one of those, you can still meditate with that mind state. You know, you can get really absorbed into a good rant, a good aversion, or get totally absorbed into sloth and torpor. You know, just go completely asleep. And you know, if it's something that you habitually do, it's like the mind can just sort of go into that kind of rut. You know, it's like with, say, with aversion, you know, it can give you a lot of energy and you know, might be able to, you know, feed your meditation. But the Buddha in the sutta in number 108, you know, talks about that as, you know, this is a really, you know, unskillful type of meditation. And he has this really wonderful phrase that say meditation on sensual indulgence. You know, he meditates, he premeditates, he mismeditates, and he mismeditates. So it's a, you know, sort of, yeah, you can meditate, but it is not, it's not skillful, it's not profitable. So those are the first five of, you know, checking the mind if it's being obsessed. Then there's obsessions about speculation about the world, which is in the suttas, it's talked about, like, is it eternal or infinite? And then sort of all the Indian thought, the four variations on those, it, both and neither, it is or it isn't. And so that's, obsessing about, you know, speculative views. And then the next one is speculative views about other worlds. And then the last one is what we kind of talked about with the whole Khosan beings is being obsessed about disputes, being in conflict with other people in the community, or, you know, being upset that maybe something didn't go your way. You can spend lots of times, you know, sort of going back to our cabins in the afternoon and just sort of, you know, just, you know, proliferating about, you know, what did he mean when he said that, or, you know, why didn't, you know, he said he was going to do this but he ended up doing that. And you're just seeing that the mind is obsessed. And that it, you know, won't settle down, it won't be quiet if we cultivate that and continue to do that. With all of these, especially the five hindrances. And that last one, in a series of talks that Lumpur Sumedho gave, in the talks that were in the 108 Dhamma talks, that CD that was made, in his talk on the five hindrances, he redefines it instead of referring to them as hindrances, but is referring to them as the ordeals, like the Herculean ordeals, the 10 tasks that the Hercules was given. And those were like ordeals that he had to overcome. He had to, you know, sort of put himself in the famous one is the Aegean stables, and he has to clean out the stables from all the excrement from all the bulls. And he, of course, he goes in and he tries to shovel it out, but that doesn't work. You know, doesn't. And he ends up using the bulls themselves to actually divert a river to clean out the stables. The water cleans it. And you know, in a dharmic sense, this is a really wonderful story because it's like Hercules actually uses the defilements, you know, the things that are the hindrances that are causing the problem, to actually, he uses those same things to actually clean the stable. And so, you know, and it's interesting because, like, he starts off with one method and he pays attention and it doesn't work. And so he has to use his powers of observation. He has to look and see. He has to use his intelligence to figure out, okay, what can I do? And the fact that he actually uses what's right there, you know, what is right in front of him, what was creating the problem, uses that to his advantage. And like the reading we had last night from Upasaka Ghee, you know, I like the phrase, you know, the first thing you have to do is you have to stop and look. And then the first thing you have to do is understand. And so it's with these the five hindrances. It's not as Lumpur Sumedho points out. He doesn't, at least in that talk, he didn't like that terminology, because when you refer to it as a hindrance, it's like, okay, this is something that shouldn't be here. I don't want it to be here, and I need to get rid of it, and obliterate it, annihilate it. But if you look at it as an ordeal or something to learn from, then you can use it for contemplation. You can use it as a way to, almost as a way of meditating on it, not with it or through it, but you can meditate that, okay, this, when this arises, you know, to stop and look at it, start investigating how did it arise, how does it, why does it persist, what are ways that we can get some light around it. And then, again, it's like Upasaka Ghee was saying last night, that you sort of like, you know, once you actually do stop and actually look at it to allow it in, when you really do start to see that it is creating suffering, that it's not peaceful, that it is a tumor, a disease, a dart, that it is unpleasant, painful, you know, it's not that you have to push it away, it's just, you won't want to pick it up. You won't want to have it. But you can only do that if you really contemplate it, if you open up to it and allow it to be there. So that's the first of the seven. You're just seeing if the mind is obsessed, and see if it is, then you're learning ways to investigate it, to understand it. Second point would be that once you're sitting and you're sort of contemplating this right view, just asking yourself, again, contemplation, sort of asking yourself, you know, does the practice that I'm doing, does it lead to serenity? Does it lead to quenching? And because we might actually, you know, be thinking that we're practicing right view, that we are doing things right and listening to the instructions, but you know, we are in turmoil and we are suffering in certain ways. And so just bringing up the question, bringing up the uncertainty or the I wouldn't say the uncertainty, but the inquiring, and contemplating, and because there are times that obviously that there are practices that are painful in the beginning, and also produce painful results. Painful in the beginning, but bring good results. So that question of doing this meditation, is it bringing serenity? It may not initially, but so it is a practice that you bring up over time. But eventually, if you have doubts, bringing it to a teacher, finding out ways of maybe we're holding the particular meditation wrong or have a wrong view about the way we're practicing, and then we can bring it into line. And of course, there are practices that that are easy and fun to do or pleasant in the beginning, but lead to bad results, like donuts, things like that. And then there are other practices that are hard to do at the beginning, like the treadmill that's over in the Barnes room. It can be quite hard to get motivated to get onto it, but over time it produces good results. So there are meditation practices that are the same that can be hard in the beginning, but then do produce good results. So it's just asking repeatedly that question: is this leading to serenity, or at least more understanding and having faith and confidence that it's going to be leading in that direction? The third one, I kind of interpreting as just having faith that the Buddha says that sort of any teaching that is going to lead to emancipation, to liberation, has to have the Four Noble Truths in right view is one of those, and so just having confidence, having faith that the teachings of the Buddha, and this practice, the monastic life, the monastic form, is a vehicle that can lead us to liberation if we hold it correctly. So just questioning, bringing that up into our mind, that we do have that confidence, and or finding ways to strengthen that, to bring that into our consciousness. And then the fourth and the fifth one are asking the question, am I one of character of somebody who has right view? And the first one is that this is interesting, because these questions are for, it's like evaluating if you're a stream enterer, but I think they're valuable for us just to contemplate, to bring up into mind as qualities to develop. But the fifth one is what that means, the character of someone who has right view, is that even somebody who is a stream enterer, actually anybody who's any of the levels of enlightenment, can actually break some of the Vinaya rules or etiquette rules. They can either do it through, speaking too quickly and sort of misspeaking, or just a moment of, especially for a stream enterer, someone who, like a lapse of mindfulness, they might say something when they're thinking something else. Or an example would be like you could lose track of the days. Like you might have a 7-day tonic. Monks are allowed to keep sugar for, like, say, 7 days, and you might miscount, and you'd have it for 8 days or 9 days, and you'd realize that. But a stream enterer would be somebody who had really had right view. As soon as they realized whatever offense they had, they would make amends for that. They would says in the sutta that they would reveal that to their teacher or to a close friend. So I'm not encouraging everybody who sort of breaks the five precepts to email Ajahn Pasano right away and let him know, because we're trying to keep life simple for him. But one way to do it is to if you have the time, like if you meditate every morning, just to go through the whatever precepts you have, the five precepts or eight precepts, and you know, just every morning, just really quickly go through them to start the day, and even every evening when you go to before you go to sleep, just to, you know, bow to your shrine in your dwelling place, and to go through your precepts, and you know, okay, did I hold them purely? Did I, you know, was there anything that I could have done better? You know, in the morning, to go through them, just to establish that as your intention, as your goal. And then in the evening, you know, when you're going through it, or even in the moment, if that's even better, if you can catch yourself after, you know, if you've had a mental lapse and you've broken your precept, just right then and there, just acknowledge that to yourself. That's most important, is to acknowledge it to yourself. And then just to reestablish yourself in that precept. You know, like if you told a white lie or something, like, oh, that wasn't really skillful. And then just determine to do better with that. You don't need to do it in front of Ajahn Pasano or anybody. If you start noticing a trend that it is a problem, then you could go to a teacher and get guidance on that. But yeah, just being truthful to ourselves and revealing that. So that's the first, having character of someone with the right view. And the next one is, this is really important for all of us here, is that we have, you know, coming up for the next 9 months, we are going to have duties and responsibilities. And, you know, someone with the right view will take those on and take those on, you know, to the best of our ability, you know, joyfully, doing it with a way of trying to help the community. You know, really, just the way the retreat crew did this year, you know, just sort of to doing it really as Donna, and we can see how they really blossomed as a result of that, so taking on those duties and responsibilities, but also keeping in mind that we need to get back out into the forest and to meditate. The Buddha actually specifically says that, you know, that we take on these duties and we do them, but not at the expense of our meditation practice. And I can think of many, many good examples, especially when I was in Thailand, the one monk I'll actually point out by name was Ajahn Pratip, who lived here. He was really instrumental in a lot of construction that was happening in the monastery. And he'd be there for morning puja, go on the alms round, helped clean up the Dhamma hall after the meal is over. And it's about 9 o'clock now, and then most monks go off and do their kind of morning chore, and then the rest of the day is for meditation, at least for the time that I was there. Schedule's always changing. But Ajahn Pratip would then go off and work the rest of the morning and all afternoon until evening drink time with the local villagers who were there, helping them with the guidance on the construction projects and working with them. And then I was Ajahn Yanadama's Upatak, and I would usually most evenings be over at his kuti cleaning at that point and giving him a foot massage, and Ajahn Pratip would always come in and we'd bathe Ajahn Yana at that time. And I never knew what they were talking about because they were speaking in Thai, but Ajahn Yana told me that, you know, Ajahn Yanadama would tell me that they were usually talking about the construction work that happened that day and what needed to happen the next day. And then I'd still be with Ajahn Yana for another hour or so, and it'd be dark by that time, and then I'd go back, and I had to walk past Ajahn Pratip's cabin, and he would always be out on his walking path doing walking meditation, or his light would be on in his kuti, and I mentioned that to Ajahn Yana, and he goes, oh yeah, he usually, Ajahn Yanadama used to walk through the monastery at night and sort of see whose kuti lights were on and who was meditating, and get a sense for that, because, oh yeah, he's Ajahn Pratip, you know, always meditating. So I always think of him as an example of that, of somebody who would give great service to the Sangha, and then, but still very consciously put in that effort of meditating. So then the last two are of someone who has the strength of someone who has right view. And the first one, cue card. Listening to ear, yeah. Eager ear, yeah. Yeah, so when the Buddha said, so when there is a Dhamma talk or instructions on the Vinaya, that we listen to it with that real eagerness to, and there was a whole bunch of adjectives for it, but like, you know, sort of taking interest, wanting to, just turning your attention to hearing the Dhamma. So having that strength of, you know, just wanting to hear it, thinking about it in terms of, you know, well, how can I take that teaching and apply it into my daily life? How can I benefit from this? So yeah, it was just a real eagerness to hear the Dhamma. And then the final one, the other strength of someone with right view, is would be like you've penetrated that. You've come to understand the meaning of that particular Dhamma, and this joy arises. You know, the joy that arises from there's one way of a thing. The commentary was looking at the Pali. The words was just, it's really the joy of one of the things of a stream enter is that they have confirmed confidence in the Buddha, in the Dhamma, and the Sangha, and just that having that real, you know, real strong confidence in unshakable confidence brings a joy to it. And so, you know, even at a say non-sotapanna level, though, you know, taking joy and taking pride, having you're just seeing, you know, the happiness that comes from when we do take the teachings that we hear, the teachings that we, you know, receive at other times during the day. Sort of just when we see somebody doing something really skillfully, and we know that that's the right thing to do, or we know that that's a beautiful thing to do, like somebody today, a mysterious person, folded up the monk's tea towels, and there was a note in the monk's room that you know, somebody folded this up and they suspected it was one of the lay people. Maybe it was a monk or a novice or a anagarika, but there was a note saying, you know, I think it was maybe one of the lay people that did this. And this big sign, anumodana, you know, which means, you know, really joy at other people's, you know, generosity. And so I've took a lot of joy in just even reading the note that somebody else appreciated the fact that somebody else did something very generous, even though they don't know who it was. And so, you know, just taking that gladness and using that as a skillful means to want to support the community. So I'll end the talk very quickly, but I just want to just encourage people to just the next couple of days before we really, really start talking to each other to set the mind in a very skillful way to you know, every one of us knows that everyone else in this community has good intentions and we might do things that do irritate each other. And you know, one of the beauties though of being on the retreat is that we haven't talked too much to each other. And you know, I can see that there's, you know, so many less judgments or views and opinions because we haven't been talking about sort of speculative views and worldly things. And so, if you remember that, you know, we go into this next period, but there will be talk about speculative views and people expressing opinions. There will be more talking, but to hold that lightly. To, you know, if we do start getting irritated, to realize that, well, it's really not, maybe not the person, but it's just this, you know, particular conversation. And you know, what one skillful means is to, like at breakfast time, that's where I think a lot of kind of kidding around happens or unskillful speech, you know, to, you know, have breakfast on your own or to come into the Dhamma hall to have breakfast. Or if you do find yourself, you know, starting to, you know, say things that are, you know, maybe just trying to get a laugh or something, to, you know, practice restraint. Or if other people are doing it and you can see it's disturbing your mind, to, you know, not to be rude, but just to make a determination not to be around that, to move, to not, you know, put yourself in that situation in the future. Maybe things like that. So just learning to do and act in skillful ways and in ways to support yourself, to so you do feel that urge, that joy in going back out into the forest, and in the ways that we practice and develop our minds in the next 9 months is going to be the foundation for next year's winter retreat. So I'll just leave that for our reflection this evening.
Sadhu, 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 sadhu.